All right, well, we're here to talk about the DMCA, which, as we've already said, is a completely non-controversial and boring topic. But those of you who have been here in the past know that I normally do this panel with Daniel Baker. He is not here today. He made his plane reservations for 10 a.m. rather than 10 p.m. And therefore is winging it off to wherever it is he lives. So I'm flying solo. I'm an attorney. I deal with the DMCA, takedowns, putbacks, general copyright litigation in all its forms. So I've seen the DMCA from the legal side. The nice thing about Daniel is he usually comes in and gives you the practical side because he is the one who received the takedowns and putbacks. So I will have to sort of play both roles today to the extent I am able. Although, in the grand scheme of things, I'm going to limit our, if you just click on the second one there, that actually gets you to the, no, that one right there, yeah, that's, I'm going to limit my recitation of the actual factors of the DMCA, unless you guys have specific questions about them, because, again, we have done sort of the safe harbor talk several times over the last few years, so by now, hopefully anyone who wants to know how to make sure they're protected knows how to make sure they're protected. I do want to focus on some of the new law, the new litigation that's come out regarding the safe harbor provisions. And we'll also talk a little bit about the triennial review, which I wish I had more time to be prepared on, but I'm not. But we'll still talk about it because there are some interesting things that came out of it this this time around. So to get started, let's just talk about the DMCA itself. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act protects everything from computer software to boat hulls. So if you've got a great boat hull design that you want to copyright, DMCA is your deal. But basically what we're all here to talk about is the protection of the ISPs under the safe harbor. The ISP safe harbor provision is found in Section 512 of the Copyright Act. It basically says that if you are an internet service provider, and it's been well documented that anyone who allows user generated or user posted content can be protected as an ISP under this provision. If you allow user posted content, then as long as you follow certain requirements, you are not liable for any of the infringing nature of that user posted content. So You have a blog and someone puts in the comments some infringing material. You have, people are still running the old school bulletin boards. You have one of those and people put up infringing content. Or you happen to be the owner of YouTube. And if you are, please come talk to me after because I'd really like to work for you, Google. But only for your money. But the everyone under that spectrum is completely protected as long as they follow the requirements. The requirements are fairly simple. You name someone who can be a point of contact. You have an identified agent to receive takedowns. And when you receive a takedown, you take stuff down. And if you receive a putback, you put it back up. As long as you do those things, you're cool. And just for purposes of assisting those who haven't been here in the past or who are not familiar with some of these things, if you go to is it chillingeffects.org?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Chillingeffects.org is the is a great site for finding those forms. They've got form takedowns and form putbacks, and you can obviously just go there and use them and keep your content protected from other infringements. If you are the ISP, you just have to know what they look like, make sure they're right, and send them back. If you have any questions about any of these things, obviously seek legal assistance. As far as the protection, however, there's been a couple of real great cases for ISPs and for users and limiting copyright owners, which is frankly astounding. In the way the law normally works, because Congress and the courts tend to take a very protectionist view of things. Every now and again, there's a completely wild case that seems to take fair use to an unbelievable extreme. But for the most part, anytime a new copyright law is passed or a new copyright case comes down, unless it's a very clear-cut case of non-infringement, it tends to be a very protectionist atmosphere. Whereas in the last couple of years, there have been several cases that have made it much easier on an infringer or on a or on an ISP, and much harder on the copyright owner themselves. And the first of those we talked a little bit about last year because it came out right before DragonCon, but it was the decision on the dancing baby. Somebody put a picture of, you know, a video of her baby dancing to Prince on YouTube. And you could sort of hear the Prince song in the background, but basically it was a video of her baby dancing. And the owner of the rights to the song came in and sued over copyright infringement for having the Prince song on YouTube. Well, the courts in that case decided that not only was it not infringing because it was fair use, but that in fact the rights owner had acted inappropriately by sending the takedown and by instituting the litigation, because that rights owner had an obligation to determine whether it was fair use before they sent the takedown, before they even gave notice to YouTube to do something about it. So it takes that nature of your rights to another level. Now, how many people are really going to do that is a different question. But arguably, it is your burden now as content owner to ensure that the material you're demanding the ISP take down is actually an infringing work. It's not protected by fair use. It's not a licensed use. It's not some other okay use. What was that? That was sort of the first step in creating the burden on the users to police the sites. The second step is really just an explanation of the wording already present in the DMCA. And I'm talking about Google, well, Viacom v. Google, basically. And there are lots of other plaintiffs on either side, but Viacom, Google. And in that case, Viacom sued Google for YouTube and made proof to the court. I'm sure you're all shocked at how they were able to find infringing material on YouTube. But apparently there was some of Viacom's material on YouTube. And they found it, and they cataloged it, and in the past had sent takedowns on it. And YouTube had responded to the takedowns. That was an important element of the case. Doesn't really have anything to do with the actual ruling I'm about to tell you about, but it is critical to the case that we know that had worked in the past. And everything from Viacom sending a note to a takedown to YouTube on one 2-minute video to their practice of cataloging hundreds of thousands of infringing videos, which was probably out 2 days, and sending it into YouTube and having a bulk takedown. In both of those practices, YouTube complied with the DMCA and took down all of the infringing materials. Even when they sent in 100,000 of them at a time, YouTube generally had them down within a day or two. So that was the process, and it was working, but obviously not working to Viacom's satisfaction, because for one thing, the new material kept going up every time they sent in a takedown, and for another thing, they realized that there was often the same content posted by multiple users, or as soon as it got taken down, it would get put back up, either by the same user, which would start to incur the three strikes process, or by different users who would just happen to have downloaded it or saved it or had it themselves and put back up on YouTube for everyone to enjoy, except Viacom. And in that process, Viacom decided that we're not having a whole lot of luck on keeping our copyrighted material off YouTube. We're just going to sue YouTube. And that's what they did. That's this lawsuit. Well, Google filed for a summary judgment saying we can't possibly be liable for this under the DMCA. And the court found they were right. The court said that under the DMCA, the protection applies unless, and here's the argument that Viacom was making, unless the ISP knows or should know of the infringing nature of the work. Viacom made the argument that YouTube knows there's infringing material on YouTube. It is widely known that much of the content on YouTube violates someone's copyright. The court looked at that language, and in fact, if you, I would encourage anyone with any interest to read the order. It's fairly easy to find on the internet. It is not, in fact, copyrighted, so it's everywhere. But if you want a copy, email me and I will send you one, because not only does it have a good explanation of the ruling in this case, obviously, but it also has a good explanation of the DMCA itself. All the various provisions therein are cited in their entirety, and there's court commentary on what each of them means, as well as the legislative history, that is the congressional commentary on what it was supposed to do. All of which the court looked into and trying to determine what knows or ought to know about infringing material means. What the court determined is a very precise and almost unachievable knowledge of infringing. The fact that YouTube knows that there's a bunch of infringing stuff on there, not good enough. That I agree with. That I think is perfectly fair. You have no way of knowing what does or does not infringe, even if you know that people might be using your service to infringe. The part I have a bit of a problem with is that it provides what would seem to be more protection to someone like Google on their YouTube service than it would provide to any of you on that blog that I mentioned where you allow user comments. The reason being, one of the things this court looked at was, did you have actual knowledge of that one actual infringing video? See, Viacom listed, I don't even know how many instances of infringing material on YouTube, but each one of those is a separate and distinct video. And to say that you knew that there was infringing material means that you knew that video was there. And I don't think there's any way that anyone could ever affirmatively prove that someone at YouTube absolutely knew of the existence of every single video on YouTube. That someone sat and watched it, affirmatively saw it, and therefore was aware of its existence. Whereas if once every month or two somebody puts a video on your site, it's a lot more likely to be believed that you probably sat and watched it, saw what somebody put on. Now, you can always prove what you didn't, but it would seem that the court would be more likely to accept as sort of a given that if I put it on your website, you're going to look at it, whereas if I put it on YouTube, in and amongst the billions of other hours of video that's on there, that they saw it. So that's my one concern about this ruling, where it does seem to create more protection for the big guys than the little guys. But the other nice thing about the ruling that does apply across the board is that the court's determination of what ought to know it infringes means. See, it's one thing to say that video includes an intro phrase with someone coming in and leading into the video saying, I'm about to show you pirated content that infringes the copyright of so-and-so. Probably that's not on any of the videos. So you have to know that it was infringing, or be aware that it probably is infringing. That's where you're really going to get stuck if you're going to be held to something, because you put up a clip of a movie. It's probably assumed that, you know, unless it's clearly put on by by the copyright owner that that's an infringing video, but probably doesn't cut it, is what the court found. See, I have no way of knowing that that video is copyright infringement, because is it fair use? I don't know. Was it licensed? I don't know. Does the person who posted it actually own the rights? I don't know. Does the copyright owner have any objection to its use? I don't know. That's, just to be clear, that's not necessarily an issue of whether it's infringing or not, but obviously if the copyright owner doesn't object, then it doesn't make any difference. So because of all of those, things that you might not know about any given video, the fact that you'll never be able to prove that someone affirmatively knew that it was copyright infringement means that 99% of these cases are going to come down under that ought to know, or what ought to be a red flag. Red flag is the legislative language. If it should create a red flag of infringement, you have a duty to take it down. Well, what the court in Viacom v. Google has found is that there really isn't a red flag unless it's a flashing, waving red neon light flag, because the fact that it would prompt you to do more investigation, if it needs more investigation, it can't be a red flag. That's the language the court used in its order. If you have to go look up to see whether it's got a license, or see whether it's fair use, or see whether the copyright owner objects, then it's not inference of copyright infringement. So you don't fall under the DMCA on that either. Or, well, more to the point, you do fall under the DMCA. You don't fall under one of the exclusions to the DMCA safe harbor. So to that end, it makes it very difficult after this case, unless something else comes down later that overturns this case, it makes it very difficult to ever prove that an ISP should have taken something down on its own. Now, one of the things that we have said many times in the past, because a common question that's come up in the DMCA panels is, should I be policing my site? Do I have the obligation to police my site? And whether I do or don't, should I be doing it and taking down copyrighted material on my own? And the answer to that has always been, from our perspective at least, the way Daniel and I presented it, is no. No, you don't have that obligation. That's clearly set out in the text of the statute. The DMCA makes it very clear that you have no affirmative duty to police your own website. The copyright owner has always had the duty to police their own content. If someone's using it, it's your right. You go do something about it. Don't wait for someone else to protect you. But what we have always taken as a position is that if you take steps to go and self-police and look through your site to see if there's any infringing material, someone's infringing photographs, or someone's infringing text, or someone's infringing video clip, or any of that, and you take the affirmative steps to police that, look at it, take it down, we've taken the position in the past that sort of creates a burden on you. You've essentially taken on an obligation that you didn't otherwise have, but now that you've done it, we can hold you to it. And this case supports that to some extent by making it very clear that your best protection is the blind eye. I don't know it's there, prove I did. And therefore you can't fall under these exclusions. But it almost contradicts our argument in the sense that the restrictions the court has put on for what you have to know about any individual instance of copyright infringement is going to be almost unachievable by any plaintiff to ever prove. It's not a question of true, it's a question of evidence. And that's something that I always have a hard time convincing some of my clients of when we go to trial, is that it doesn't matter what we know. It doesn't matter what's right or what is the truth. It matters what can I prove to the judge or jury that is right or true or otherwise. So to say to a plaintiff that you have to show beyond, more likely than not, that someone actually A saw the video, saw that one specific 2-minute video clip out of the millions of hours of video on YouTube, and B, knew or should have known that that one clip was copyright infringement, when all I have to show to shoot that down is I had no idea. I don't even know who put it up. I don't know what their rights are. That is almost never going to be accomplishable. I mean, you'd have to just about have signed, notarized confessions that they knew something was infringing before you started a lawsuit to ever prove that. So it is still sound advice, and I'm not going to contradict any of my earlier panels. It is still sound advice to not self-police, because you're opening yourself up. But after this case, it makes it very, very unlikely that any one work is ever going to be found to be excluded under the DMCA safe harbor provision. And it creates that additional burden on the copyright owner to again, police their own work, send in the takedowns, and respond accordingly. And it's very good, I think, to see, because without the DMCA, without these safe harbor provisions specifically, we would have never gotten into Web 2.0. We won't get into wherever we're going from here, because the risks would be too great. No site anywhere would ever allow random individuals to put whatever they wanted on their content site, because you'd be liable for contributory infringement or vicarious infringement otherwise. And in other words, if not for the DMCA safe harbor, then every single instance of infringement, and I'm not talking just putting clips of Viacom's movies up there, I'm talking about a guy we had here a few years back who had someone using a copyrighted smiley at the end of their posts and got a notice. Every one of those would be liable for copyright infringement under the Copyright Act, and if there's statutory infringement, liable for, you know, up to whatever statutory limits there are, up to $150,000. That's for willful, but I mean, it certainly could be. And you're looking at $150,000 per smiley. So that can get kind of high. So without this, no one, not only YouTube, but, you know, not your Aunt May, is going to allow anyone to put any content on their website. And it's great to see that the court is really making that burden stick to the people who own the content and not the websites, because that's going to continue to allow web growth and web development. Yes. You want to just use this one?
I'm wondering specifically about the Napster precedent. Did the court discuss the relevance of how YouTube promoted itself and the purpose for which it marketed itself?
Well, that was an interesting thing. Let me just address the Napster precedent for a second. Napster, Grokster, any of those various peer-to-peer litigations that have come before this were dismissed in their entirety. Viacom did use them to try to say, look, see, we shut this down all the time. We're trying to protect content. And the court found that those don't have any applicability to the current case or to the DMCA at all, because they're not ISPs under the definition of the DMCA. An ISP has to be someone who allows for the storage of content, to put it in its most simple terms. And so, because I can upload a video to YouTube and it then stays on YouTube, it is an ISP by the DMCA. When I put my material on a peer-to-peer file sharing system, it's just sort of circling around or stays on my computer or goes various sites, depending on what type of system you're on. But all of those, none of those have anything to do with one specific site being a warehouse, in simple terms, for content.
Well, it's working now.
And so from that perspective, the DMCA wouldn't have applied to Napster or Grokster, and in fact wasn't even raised by the courts in those cases. Whereas here, the DMCA safe harbor provision completely excludes any of those other claims, because what those were brought on, what Napster was guilty of, was contributory infringement. And with YouTube, it has the protection of the DMCA, which says that I would otherwise be liable for contributory infringement, but I'm protected by this shield that Napster didn't have. So, but for this shield, I would have gotten hit with the same with the same bullet that Napster got, but I have it, so I can't. And that's the distinction. And I think you had a follow-up on that.
So even if you promoted yourself basically as a pirating service, if you qualified as an ISP?
Well, we haven't seen the Pirate Bay case yet. So let's see. But no, I think that's exactly right, because there was evidence presented in this action. And this might be what came down to the court. There was evidence presented that both sides were kind of being jerks about it. But certainly the fact that YouTube promoted itself as a source of content, knowing that much of that content was infringing. YouTube is not the Pirate Bay, and so they don't come right out and say, come here to get your free shit. Sorry, no, any kids in here? Sorry. But you know, come here to get content. It might be copyrighted content. It might be some kid showing you his skateboarding videos. It might be that lady's dancing baby. Whereas someone who specifically advertises come here and get infringing materials would be taking a very different stance and putting out more of a likelihood that you'd be able to prove that they knew or should have known that the material they were promoting was infringing. So that's the YouTube side of it. The other flip side is, and I think this had as much to do with the court deciding that that wasn't a problem as the actual analysis that I just gave you, is that at the same time Viacom was complaining about people using its copyrighted stuff, it was having its own agents upload stuff to YouTube to get some viral marketing. And so it's hard to turn around and say that you're right. You're creating this problem that we are helping you create. So the appearance of copyrighted information on YouTube is not the sole purpose of existence of YouTube. I mean, we may think so, but YouTube doesn't.
Okay, my question is about the combined and what you might think is the combined impact of last year's case and this year's case, with the dancing baby case in this case, is that maybe, I guess I was wondering if some of these companies who have been terrorizing people who have been fairly using their material for, like, I don't know, satire or whatever, mm-hmm. if they might actually, like, lay off a little bit.
What I'm trying to think of a good way to say, God, I hope not, because that pays my mortgage.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
But I'll just say that. Yes, I think that it should. The reason being twofold. One, this creates a much higher burden on ever getting to the ISP. And frankly, copyright litigation costs an awful lot of money, and it's just not worth it to sue individuals. Unless there is just such a ubiquitous use of your work that you have got to shut them down, you're never going to get your money back. And the best you can hope for is to stop the infringement, but that's fine if you have an identified person who you can go after. Find me the actual identity of a lot of people on the internet. It can be challenging to even figure out who it is you're supposed to sue, much less hope that you're going to get anything out of, you know, some guy living in his mom's basement. And you're never going to get your money back, so you're never going to bring that suit. That's why they're going after YouTube and Google and AOL or any of the other, you know, places where you can hope to generate a recoverable judgment. So with that being much more off the table, I think it's very unlikely that you would see, if this had come out a different way, I think you'd see a ton of cases where they would sue you and YouTube. But now that they can't sue YouTube and can just sue you, or at least can't sue YouTube in any meaningful way, I think that that's going to limit people who are going to be willing to bring those suits. Now, the combined effect of the Dancing Baby case says that copyright owners should self-police. They should look at it and say, is this a fair use? Is this something that is really infringing my work? Is this something that's really causing me harm? As a practical reality, is anyone really going to do that? Probably not. Because every content owner I have ever worked for has come into me screaming bloody murder about infringement every time that you know, the merest hint of infringement comes along. And it's my job to, you know, try to talk them off the cliff or push them over if it's clearly infringement. But there are plenty of cases that I have had to talk people out of bringing because it really wasn't infringement, really wasn't fair use, really wasn't their stuff, whatever. And so that to some extent should happen, but I think that the reality is people will still be firing out takedowns with every perceived instance of infringement. What it should be encouraging you all to do is to be more aggressive with your putbacks. If you really think it's not infringing, put it back. Let the content owner sue you. Because at that point, they will have to make the decision of, filling out a takedown is something that I can do by myself. Well, I'm an attorney, obviously, but you can do by yourself, you know, at home, in the evening, while you're watching TV. Whereas actually instituting that litigation, if the putback goes through, is a much more costly and time-consuming process and requires the assistance of professional counsel. So you're gonna be a lot less likely to take that next step if there's any gray area than you would in sending out the initial takedown. So I've
got two questions. You mentioned that Viacom had their own agents putting stuff up on YouTube. All right, well, that brings a related question. If you have a site that displays content that users upload, is there an automatic implied right granted if someone uploads content, or do you really need to have an user license agreement, or
there's really no implied right or license when it comes to copyright law. If I upload, you know, let's just say you have the easiest example of this, because this is where it comes up, is a photography website. Let's say you have a website where you allow people to post their own photographs, and somebody has a really nice one, and you decide you're going to use that as part of your advertising campaign, or just, you know, as your front page logo or whatever. without any express agreement with the author, then that use would be infringing. It would be no less infringing than if I went to your website, downloaded that image onto my computer and started printing out flyers for my law office with it.
So if a content creator uploads a picture to a site, then, since they have not expressly given them right to display it, even though they,
well, the right to display it is a different thing. If you're allowing people to post the content
right
where it can be viewed by others, then by posting it where it can be viewed by others, I'm obviously allowing it to be viewed.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a difference with like video, yeah, because, you know, I go to YouTube, click a button, and get the widget.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, let's say I review movies, and I'm like, I find, you know, some movie that was on YouTube, and I'm writing my review about it, and I just throw a slug of HTML in there that takes the, it's not copying it.
Right.
It's just a link to display the Flash video.
Right.
Versus me actually taking, downloading a copy of the file, uploading it on my server, you know.
And in that case, see, here's where we started getting into some of the fair use areas. That would be allowable because you're acting as a movie critic and you're using it in part of your criticism, which would most likely be a fair use usage. Whereas if you simply went and got that video and put it somewhere else in some other site for some other viewing, might infringe someone's copyright. So that's where the difference is. If you watch. You know, if you allow people to post content where people can see it, they can't sue you for people seeing it. But if you then take that content and use it for your own purposes somewhere else on the site, you would need to have an agreement. Now, can that agreement be a EULA? Sure. If you put something in your EULA that says, by putting your pictures here, you grant me full use to use this in any way around this site, fine. If you put in the EULA, you grant me full use to print and sell T-shirts with this image on it, you could still do that, but you'd expect a lot less content to get put on. But that's where it comes down. If you come down and
right. Everyone in the room is carrying
right there you go
carrying
you got
around
one.
An EULA, so. which I personally yep. like the third section.
Yeah, everybody's reading their badge now.
Yeah, whereas section two says, hey, Dragon Con can use your image, whatnot. Section three, you cannot use image.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, granted, that's to cover Dragon Con's.
Yes.
And it's unlikely, but.
Yeah, that's scale, right there. You go.
That one more reason why it's good to be staff. One more reason you should volunteer and staff.
All right. And
this entire session.
You're saying about YouTube and takedowns. My understanding is the takedowns normally done for YouTube are not actual DMCA takedowns. They're just internal notices. That's why they have the less than 4 days to re-up after the thing. The second thing is, it was brought up in a question during the Three Strikes panel on Friday morning, but I'm not aware of any perjury cases dealing out of the DMCA. Are you?
No. Let me be clear. Are you suggesting that someone says that, I've known this guy has been posting stuff three dozen times, but I'm going to say I had no knowledge of him going on Three Strikes?
At the tail end of the DMCA notice, you know, why certify the above true under penalty of perjury?
Am I aware of any perjury? Frankly, I'm not aware of any perjury cases in general. Perjury gets used in high-end criminal cases and Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Well, right. And now we've got a Consejo coming in before the Congress. But yeah. Clemens, sorry, yeah.
But there's no notices for a false DMCA statement. I mean, I know of quite a few dozen intentionally false statements where they're not agents or they're not
right.
representatives.
If it was something that came up repeatedly, let's say you had someone who was being intentionally harassing through takedowns.
I mean, I know of Mini Nova used to get 3,500 DMCA notice takedowns every month just from one person.
And at that point, does the ISP have any obligation to do anything? Probably not.
Yeah,
they've got to go ahead and really that sort of comes down to the self-policing. Are you reviewing the nature of each takedown, or are you just assuming that each takedown, as long as it's properly filled out and formatted now? The kind of person who sends in 3,500 individual takedowns is the kind of person who probably writes them in purple crayon.
It was Warner Brothers, and it was in a Excel file.
Oh well, that's a different thing. But yeah, so yeah. But as long as they're properly filled out and properly authenticated and everything is done, I think the ISP is much safer complying with them and letting the content the person who uploaded the content follow through with the putback if they have any interest in doing so. See, that's the other nature of a DMCA takedown that is a bit censorious. It's easy to go ahead and send in a takedown that is questionable, knowing that even though the ISP has an obligation to attempt to contact the person whose content was removed, in most of these scenarios, you're not dealing with people who are there and available and ready to put it back up, or even necessarily still at the same address. So your chances of ever getting a putback are very slim. You know, there's not a lot of opportunity I put it this way, not opportunity, but there's not a lot of likelihood that you're going to get that content put back up, even if it's very gray or almost just sort of dingy white, as to whether there's actually any infringement or not. It's just people are sending them in because they have the effect they're looking for, which is to take the content down. Now, if the person who sent 3,500 individual notices was on him all against that same person, there would be an ability to use that perjury as part of a variety of other claims against that person for the harassment. Yeah. See, when I receive all those takedowns, when every piece of content I have ever put up on the web comes down, all because of one guy who doesn't own the content decided he had a vendetta against me, I have different claims, and the perjury can be part of that. Certainly the evidence of the perjury will be part of it. But is anyone ever going to get prosecuted individually for perjury by the criminal authorities? No.
It's a shame you actually have a provision in law and not actually have it enforced.
Well, but that is, again, though, where the new the new burdens on the copyright owner to make sure that it really is infringement, again, work to our advantage. Hopefully that will get more fleshed out, and we'll come into an arena where an ISP does have the ability to, if it chooses to, gauge the quality of its takedowns. And the reason I say if it chooses to, because imagine if you run your own personal website, you receive 3,500 takedowns, you're not going to want to spend the time to go through it. But a business like Google can certainly employ someone to go through and check things. And does it give you the benefit of being able to say, you know what, I'm not even going to comply with this takedown, but I'm still going to be protected because you didn't follow through on your first steps? That's where I'd like to see it go, but again, I don't want to create an additional burden on the ISP.
Could that be used against somebody who put something in LiveJournal?
Any place that content is uploaded, yes. I'm not sure what the question of can it be used is. If someone uploads infringing material, if they type it in, you type the entire shooting script for Kick-Ass into the LiveJournal, yes, you're liable for copyright infringement. Is LiveJournal protected? Yes, because of the DMCA, as long as they follow the right steps. So, again, the question of can somebody be liable, the end user, the person who uploaded the content, can always be liable for the infringement.
So to address your question specifically, if I'm running a Facebook page and somebody posts on my wall infringing material, Facebook is immune.
Mm-hmm.
I, as the owner of that wall, am immune. The person who posted it is not. And if Facebook gets a takedown notice, they simply remove the content.
Right. At that point, it's more likely to go through Facebook than you. You're probably never going to see it other than your content disappearing. Because you don't have anyone authorized to receive notices for your Facebook page, I'm fairly certain.
Yeah, we don't have a registry.
Right.
No.
But the truth remains that you're also not going to be the one who gets hit for it. It would be the ultimate the person who undertook the infringing act by putting the material on. That person can always get sued. And whether they get sued or not, you know, we've all seen the RIAA tactics. There's plenty of college kids getting sued for millions of dollars just to make a point. So it is very possible now that Viacom says, all right, well, our YouTube case went south, so everyone in this room expect to get a notice from Viacom that you're being sued over any content you've ever put up. You know, so it is very possible they use the RIAA strategy in the hopes of trying to shut down that avenue, but it is also very possible that they realize that was a giant waste of money and don't.
Because I know a lot of people put stuff on their LiveJournal, and a lot of people put stuff from YouTube on their LiveJournal.
Well, again, when you're just you know, when you're bringing in that YouTube video and putting it on your LiveJournal, you have to be concerned not just that you're using, you know, Viacom stuff or Universal stuff or CBS or anybody else. You have to be concerned that the person who put it up on YouTube, even if it's not Viacom, it's just that kid skateboarding or the woman and dancing baby, they all have copyright protection for those videos too. So you're sort of doubling your risk when you put something up there. But again, you've got the open question of, am I doing it with fair use? Am I doing it in a way that's going to offend the copyright user? Is that copyright owner ever going to come after me? You know, it all depends on how you use it and where you use it.
Now that would apply to you have tools that'll rip a video right off of YouTube. You rip the video off, you put it on your Facebook page. Yeah, you could be open for infringement.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay. However, if you use the YouTube embedded link function, so it shows on your page, but it's actually over on YouTube, are you liable for infringement?
Probably not, because the people who put it up on YouTube, again, would be authorizing the use on YouTube of anyone viewing it on YouTube. And all you're doing is basically telling someone to go look at this YouTube video.
Yeah, and it may play on your page,
right,
but
right.
It's actually streaming off
but
of
that's,
YouTube.
That's simply a functionality of YouTube that's allowed, and it is almost certain. I don't have their EULA in front of me, but I guarantee you it's in there.
That's why they give you the slow.
Right.
Yeah.
So and that's why it has a little, you know, the YouTube logo and everything else on it. So
now the risk to a average person, I get asked this a lot, which is why I'm asking. There may be other people with this who get this question also. People will come up and say, well, there's this TV show I like, and it's on YouTube. Is it okay to watch that? And my attitude is, you don't know who posted it.
Right.
You can watch it all you want. It's not infringing. Now, you download it to your hard drive. Now you could be infringing. And if they can figure out that you downloaded a copy, highly unlikely. they could, in fact, come after you.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. You're simply viewing infringing material doesn't make you a contributory infringer by any stretch. You may be encouraging the infringement by creating a market for it, but you're not going to be liable for the infringement. Download and redistribute that video, and you could certainly be liable for contributory infringement. But that again, yeah. Do you know? Is anyone going to sue you? These are all big questions.
Actually, I've often wondered about that. Technically speaking, streaming content is downloading it. It's being downloaded and played in the background. So,
mm-hmm.
What's the difference between that and saving it to another folder?
Absolutely nothing by the legal definition, because there's been I do a lot of work for video game companies, and one of the things that's been a great boon for litigation in that area is the fact that simply playing the video game is a creation of a copy. So, you know, again, you are given the right to do that when you watch YouTube by its very nature of being there. You are given the right to create the copy in your computer as you are playing through the software by buying the software. But if you didn't buy the software, then you are arguably creating copyright infringement, because you are making an infringing copy at the moment it goes through your system.
Okay. There was also the case maybe 18 months ago, I think it was a cable company using a PVR system with a storage-based
mm-hmm.
on their system, and because it had a copy that was made of, I think it was 0.7 seconds, the courts decided that that wasn't actually a fixed copy. It was a very temporary copy. So the length of the copy made a difference. It was something like 4 seconds or less was acceptable.
Oh, right. I wouldn't rely on that though, because
one circuit judge.
Right, and there's a lot of other cases that have said that
even
putting it in memory, even though it's in memory and then gone, is creation of a copy. You know, that's been specifically limited so far that I'm aware of only to computer usage, but obviously that's the big issue that we're discussing here today. So,
all right, the next thing is about territoriality. Overseas.
Right.
A lot of people, you said Pirate Bay, based in Sweden.
Right.
Well, Sweden, Netherlands, everywhere it's bounced around. ISO Hunt, based in Canada, also been done for DMCA.
Well, the issue with the DMCA is, of course, it is just U.S. law, and it only protects in the U.S. Now, copyright, we're all subject to the Berne Convention and the reciprocity that comes along with that suggests that others ought to protect U.S. works overseas, and U.S. and overseas works ought to be protected in the U.S.
Isn't ACTA trying to take care of that?
But it is, again, the issue becomes the actual practical application of these rights.
Because in the Pirate Bay case, what really rankled a lot of people was that they'd send a DMCA notice to the Pirate Bay. Mm-hmm. They'd say, it's a U.S. law, we're legal under Swedish law, and go away, retractable baton, all the rest of it.
That's right. And that's, and that's remains to be seen how well that's going to work.
Yeah, because the appeal is in 4 weeks,
right
after the election, next week.
So it's
vote pirate.
It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how that comes down. But that is one of the difficulties, and that's not new. I mean, that has nothing to do with the digital age. Charles Dickens had a real problem with American copyright law. So it's nothing. There's nothing new under the sun. The only question is, how are we going to deal with it today? Any other questions? Nope, we got.
A lot of book publishers put their videos on YouTube. If you download the video, is that questionable?
Here's the answer. If you download something from YouTube, are you violating any laws? I don't know. Depends on what's there. Depends on who posted it and how you got it and what you're doing with it and what they're doing with it and a variety of other things. Can you expect to ever see a copyright litigation come out of that? No. I would be 99.9% willing to guarantee you that you will never, ever, ever see litigation over something that you downloaded off YouTube onto your hard drive or embedded on your Facebook page or did anything else with. Simply because, again, you're getting so far afield from the person who put that there. And you don't have the protections of the DMCA, but you still have the ability to say that you had no way of knowing it was or wasn't infringing. If they put it up on YouTube and it's available for download, and someone like Viacom or CBS or anyone else puts their own content up there and knows that it can be downloaded, and it is downloaded, they should have no objection. If I put CBS's content up there, CBS would certainly have an objection, but how do you know whether it's me or CBS? Or me acting on behalf of CBS? Or me with a license to put it up there? Or any other fair use provision? And it's just impossible to tell. So that's why I can say that whatever you download off YouTube, and I'll say I've got a bunch of young kids, so we watch the Muppets on YouTube all the time. Well, there's plenty of stuff from the Muppets that's put up by other people, but there's plenty of stuff from the Muppets that's put up by the Muppets. And so which one's which? Hard to tell. And it is an open question, I think, whether any given piece of video on YouTube is in and of itself infringing.
More of a just clarification of what you were just saying than a question, but like she's asking about if you just download a video, store it locally, and then just view it for your own personal use, there's really no way for them to track that?
Probably not yet.
And so the big problem is if you download it and then redistribute it. That's the problem.
Right. And that's the thing you need to remember is that's always the real issue. I mean, theoretically, I can go to a bookstore, buy a book, and photocopy it. And that's copyright infringement. I don't know why I do that necessarily, unless I'm afraid I might spill my coffee on it. But I can do that, and it's copyright infringement. But no one is ever going to come to my house and complain that I made a copy of a book and stuck it in my desk drawer. If I make a lot of copies of that book and start selling it, then someone is clearly going to become knocking on my door. And that's the that's the real issue for the private user. Right. Even right. Exactly.
Yeah, the whole Harry Potter thing when the Harry Potter book came out.
So that's the real question for copyright infringement is, are you doing something that is going to anger the copyright owner?
Now, to go back what Frank here said about, when you view YouTube, you are actually downloading an ephemeral copy on your hard drive. Well, if they so chose to say, oh, that's copyright infringement, you've got a copy. Well, they've just opened a can of worms they really didn't want to open. Here's why. When you go to ABC or CBS or NBC's website, how do you know they put that content there? You don't. You assume they put it there. Well, all of a sudden, if the burden of proof is on the end person to verify that that is not copyright material so that when I view it and it goes to my hard drive, I'm not an infringer, it essentially cuts off every media agency that produces media on the internet, including the the people like NBC, ABC, and CBS.
Yeah, I mean, at no point, really,
not gonna go there.
At no point is anyone ever going to have an objection to the person who is receiving the copyrighted material. I mean, even on the case where where I'm selling a pirated copy of something, the copyright owner is going to come after me as the guy who's making a profit off of it or distributing their work, versus the people who receive the work. Now, are the people who receive the work potentially going to be involved in the sense of demanding a return of the infringing goods? But you're not going to get. No one sues the receiver of the goods. The copyright infringement suit is going to go against the person who is distributing the infringing goods, and that's where it comes in. It's the person who uploads the infringing content to YouTube that would be liable, rather than, as the court has now said, rather than YouTube itself, and certainly as opposed to any of the people who have viewed that content on YouTube, if they could even be identified and found.
Well, it's nothing like receiving stolen goods.
Well, receiving stolen goods is the same nature of you might be required to return. If I sell you, the Harry Potter book, you would probably be required to return it to the proper owner, and you would then be out your money. But you probably wouldn't yourself face litigation, even criminal litigation, in receiving stolen goods, unless you were, if you're the fence, then that's something they're going to use to get you with. But if you're the guy who bought the Rolex that somebody stole from grandma, you're not going to be in trouble for that. You're just going to have to give the Rolex back. One quick question.
By the way, I work at a university, and we get DMCA takedown notices. And universally, they're using a peer-to-peer sharing program. And if they had just gone to a website and simply downloaded the file of their machine, and that was it, probably nothing would have ever heard of it. However, because they're using peer-to-peer, as soon as they start downloading it, they begin sharing it. They become a distributor, and that's what gets them into trouble.
Before we leave, obviously, you know, it's 2 o'clock. If you guys need to get somewhere else, I will not be offended if you get up and leave. But because we did have triennial review on the list, I want to make sure we at least mention the words triennial review so that you'll come back next year and talk to me again.
Can you explain what that is?
The triennial review process. See, the DMCA, the people, amazingly, the people who drafted the law actually thought ahead. Never happens otherwise, but they did realize that we're treading into unknown waters. We're starting to create. See, one of the problems with copyright law is that as a general matter, outside of the DMCA, we're still dealing with the law that was drafted in 1978. So nothing that we're dealing with today even existed in 1978, whether that be the internet or DVDs or digital recordings of any sort or any of the other modern technology issues. Digital rights management was not anything anybody thought about in 1977 when they were writing the law. So you're working to try to shoehorn all these modern elements into past law. And when they drafted the DMCA, they'd started to see some of that and started to realize there were some areas that the shoehorn didn't necessarily fit. And so they put in place a procedure to review certain elements and to make changes to the law as needed in the triennial review process. Let's make sure it's still working. Every 3 years, we're going to sit down and say, is it working out for us? Is there anything that needs to be changed? Is there anything people have a question with? And there's a way to submit things to the Library of Congress to... I'm sorry? Apparently I don't know. but yeah, there is a way to submit things that you would like to see changed. And that's part of the triennial review, and a lot of people do that. And the EFF, interestingly, EFF is one of them, and they've been very down on the process in recent years. They've gone so far as to call the triennial review process broken. And to some extent, I might agree with that. let me put it this way: I don't agree with that. I don't think the process itself is broken. You still have the ability to submit your changes. They will be considered by the Copyright Office, and they will be ruled on accordingly. But taking into account the statement I made when I first came in, that the law as it generally stands and the law as it is generally interpreted is very protectionist, the likelihood of your request to have something excluded from copyright protection is slim. So take, for example, iPhones or any digital rights management. Digital rights management has been a bane of many people's existence for quite some time. And so, along with the EFF, many, many other people have submitted for the triennial review requests to get rid of or limit or create exceptions to digital rights management. And the Library of Congress generally doesn't do that. One reason is, in part, the protection of copyright owner content. But the other reason is protection of contract. You know, most of the things that you get that have any DRM included in them are things that you purchased. And when you purchase them, much like when you upload your content to the site and are automatically subject to the EULA, much like we all have this right here that we agreed to, even though until he mentioned it, none of us read it. all the things that you automatically agree with and contract for, all those are included in what you purchase with digital rights management embedded in it. You purchase a DVD, you're implicitly agreeing that you won't do anything that Sony said you couldn't do. You purchase software, you are implicitly agreeing that you, and in fact expressly agreeing with the shrink wrap licensing and any click-through licensing, that you won't do anything that the software distributor didn't want you to do. So that contract, more than the copyright law, binds you to the digital rights management agreement. So that's one of the reasons the Copyright Office has not been inclined to go against it. The other, of course, is the very protectionist attitude. I mean, we all see that, you know, every couple of years they extend the life of copyright so that Mickey Mouse won't ever go public. But it is not a broken process. It is just a system designed to protect large corporate entities that own a lot of copyrights.
And politicians, right.
And you know, that's fine to some extent, but it is what it is. Now, interestingly, this last go around, the Library of Congress said it's perfectly okay to jailbreak your iPhone. So it is now perfectly legal to do what Steve Jobs said you can't. And that's again a surprising step, much like the outcome of this case. I think the case was very rightly decided under DMCA, but I'm surprised it went as far as it did. And the same can be said for the triennial review this time around. I haven't reviewed every provision of it. I don't know all of what came down, but I know that one, and that is very, very surprising given the way things have come out in the past. So I think that you know, it'll be interesting to see where things go. When I do this panel next year, there might be a whole lot of new things to talk about. Or there might be me saying, okay, remember all that stuff I said last year? The courts have shut it down. So we'll find out. Any other questions? All right, well, if anybody wants to know anything, you always have the right to email me or you know, see me in the hall or anything else, and I'll be glad to talk to you further. Otherwise, see you next year.